The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.
What explains the lunacy of our present political leadership, our feckless leadership? The explanations are varied, of course, but they generally cannot be grouped under stupidity. Ignorance, often, but stupidity, no. You don't get to the positions of influence that these people occupy because you're unable to tie your own shoes or drive a car or navigate your way through an Ivy League college. The question is not a matter of intelligence, but rather what they believe intelligence is for. At the end of the day, as they have come to believe, intelligence is a device that evolution gave you so that you could watch out for numero uno. Right? This is God gave you horsepower, God gave you intellectual RPM so you could watch out for yourself. When a nation gets to the point where they are destroying wealth in the name of creating it, what came unhinged? When critics of destroying wealth in the name of creating it say something like, and get shouted down as haters of humanity, what is the name of this particular derangement syndrome? What was your reaction, for example, to Cash for Clunkers, the program early in Obama's tenure? If it was anything less than that is evil, then you have a problem. Destroying perfectly operational cars as a way of stimulating the economy is insanity. We see the phenomenon in other areas. A drunk can know perfectly well that drink is killing him, but to turn away from what is destroying him will bring about an acute convulsion. He has a choice. There is the gradual and comparatively smooth path toward death, and the convulsive and tumultuous period of going cold turkey and life on the other side. All right, so he can have acute pain now and be dried out a month from now, or he can continue the slow downward path. This is an illustration on the individual level, but when a nation reaches this stage, the leaders all recognize that a political convulsion or upheaval will mean that many of them, if not most of them, will lose their jobs. The rhetoric, of course, is all about public service. But if what the public needs is a bout of the DTs and to watch some recessionary pink elephants for a few fiscal quarters, then what our Solons will actually do is serve us up another drink, and it will be a stiff one. And they will do this until we are face down in the gutter. This is called more of the hair of the dog that bit you economics. Now, this explains those whose personal livelihoods depend upon America staying drunk. The bartender, the keg delivery guy, the gang at the brewery, all those guys. But what explains those Christians who, from a distance and with no apparent personal stake in it, tell us that what Christ would have done in this situation is to serve up another round of real hooch? What explains the Christians who do not have a personal interest in it, like your congressman does? Certain sins of empathetic connection operate at a distance. These are the sins of sentimentalism, envy, jealousy, personal inadequacy, pettiness, and so on. A man in Washington, D.C. who fights to keep his department from being closed down, because he will be out on the street if it does, is like a dog fighting over a piece of meat. It is not a flattering picture, but it is not inexplicable either. We understand why people have turf battles. We understand why people protect their own turf. But how to explain the Christian left? Christians with a vivid imagination and a romantic nature have no trouble projecting all of their personal issues onto the screen that they call America. They can keep their distance, believe whatever they want to, and feed their own sense of indignant righteousness, which they keep chained up in their emotional basement. What actually happens to poor people as a result of their suggested policies is not something they really care about. They are more interested in feeding their grievances than they are interested in feeding the poor. The welfare bureaucrat in Washington loves the poor in a different way. The poor are his cash cow. They are the butter spread on his side of the bread. The conflict of interest is palpable and not hard to explain at all. When poverty is solved, then the people who make their living off of solving poverty are out of a job. But the suburban aspiring Amos reads Sojourner's Magazine, and is full of fulminations against hard-hearted conservatives, all while driving an expensive Volvo all around his side of Bashan Hills. He shops at Whole Foods, using a recyclable burlap bag, one that will hide the fact that he pays three times as much for his food as normal people do. He has scabs all over his heart because he won't stop picking at it, and he calls it compassion. So we are dealing with the institutionalization of envy. And I think I need to address a reasonable question, quite reasonable question, that may have risen in the minds of some. Here is a situation that might cause this question. How hard is it for many people to feel sorry for the rich who are being oppressed by our current system of democratic pillage? Poor buddy's having trouble with his yacht payments, etc. All right. The question that could arise can be formed in scriptural terms this way. Where in scripture does it warn us of the great moral peril of oppressing the rich? Why is the preponderance of warnings directed against those who would rip off the poor? Why is that the emphasis of scripture? Why are you in these podcasts attacking the envious and attacking the grievance mongers and so forth? And it seems like you're coming down on the side of the rich. There are a number of ways to answer this. So let me mention one briefly. An answer that operates on the very practical level. But I then want to move on to the central moral myopia that the question represents. The practical reason we are not warned against the pillage of the rich is that democracies as we know them today did not exist back then. We are not warned in this way for the same reason that we are not told in the Bible to avoid computer fraud. Robbing the rich on a wide scale is not mentioned for the same reason that the instrument for accomplishing this, the House of Representatives, is also not mentioned. But there's a real blind spot revealed by the question. Where does the Bible tell us not to steal from the rich? In the same place where it tells us not to steal, period. That commandment is in the same place where we're told not to steal from Ford Motor Company, steal from Walmart, steal from your mother's purse, or any other place where the money you want might happen to be found. The morality of the thing has nothing whatever to do with the moral condition of the victim or with his extra resources. Stealing is stealing whether or not the person involved would ever miss it, and envy is envy even if the wealthy are parading about in some unconscionable, ostentatious fashion. What is that to us? It is not our money. We must not want it, seek it, angle for it, manipulate for it, vote for it, or write prophetic Jeremiads with one eye on the main chance. The only thing we may do to get some is by offering a lawful service diligently performed. Surrounding the palace with ballots is no more acceptable than surrounding the palace with torches and pitchforks. When we are commanded not to covet anything that belongs to our neighbor, the command presupposes that the neighbor concerned is someone who actually has all that stuff. I can't covet the wives of bachelors. I don't covet the car of a man who has only a bike. The 10th commandment presupposes that envy and covetousness is operating in some sense uphill. In effect, we are commanded not to oppress the poor, and we are also commanded by definition not to envy the rich. And this is the sin into which America has fallen headlong. We have perversely defined greed as someone with a goodish bit of his own money wanting to keep it. And we have defined altruism as the desire to get someone else's money for free. Isaiah 5:20 is a passage for just such a time as this. America is materialistic, all right, but not in the way that our common sense says we are. Envy is in our bones, and it is certainly in our voting patterns.
New St. Andrews College thanks you for listening.